From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
I suspect that you will be as convinced as I am and as convinced as everybody else who has seen this case. This is a crap piece of case.
A second City Hall official indicted, an interim headmaster named at Boston Latin School, and more in our Week in Review. Also today, Angelo Tillis, manager at the Hatch Shell for more than 30 years, and why he wants your help. All that confetti.
Whoever's listening now, please, if you come, help me out. Grab a handful. It's a good souvenir. I mean, you can say I got this at the Hatch Shell.
Plus, how Igor Stravinsky's unorthodox arrangement of the Star-Spangled Banner landed him in hot water with the Boston police. That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, so let's jump right into the Week in Review, starting with more trouble at City Hall. This week, federal authorities arrested a second member of Marty Walsh's administration on charges of union-related extortion. The mayor was quick to respond.
If these allegations are true, simply really disheartening. It concerns me.
Tim Sullivan, the city's chief of staff of intergovernmental relations, is charged with threatening to withhold city permits from the Boston Calling Music Festival unless the festival producers hired union stagehands. Sullivan's lawyer, William Santolo, lashed back at the U.S. Attorney's Office, saying a major ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court this week found that routine politician courtesies are not corruption.
When you read the opinion, and then when you read the indictment, I suspect that you will be as convinced as I am and as convinced as everybody else who has seen this case. This is a crap piece of case.
Still, many are wondering how this new corruption case will affect Mayor Walsh. The mayor's known Sullivan for years. Thomas Farragher, columnist for the Boston Globe, says it's time for Walsh to hit the reset button.
If I were him, I would bring in a whole new crew of people who are a little more seasoned. I think he needs an adult... in the room. I think he needs to reach out in more vigorous ways to business leaders, neighborhood advocates.
Well, joining us to discuss this story and the rest of the week's news is Dante Ramos, op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe. Good to have you back, Dante.
Great to be here.
And thanks for being here on the start of the 4th of July weekend. Charlie Chipio joins us as well. He's a research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and head of Chipio Strategies. Great to see you as well, Charlie.
Thank you. Good
and
to be here.
And happy early 4th of July to you as well. So let's start with this second charge of corruption and extortion to a member of Mayor Walsh's administration. Dante, your first thoughts on the impact of this story?
I think this story deepens some of the questions that have been out there about Mayor Walsh. He's a former labor leader, and since the beginning of his candidacy for mayor, really, this question has been on the table of whether labor will exercise an outsized influence over his administration. And, you know, he's taken pains rhetorically to say that that's not so. This case, obviously, the second arrest in this Boston Calling situation, suggests that, either the word is on the street or the word was on the street within the administration that this is something that, was a priority of the administration to get more jobs for labor groups, or it's something that, if the mayor wasn't putting that policy out officially, then somebody decided that it was, and that, perhaps the mayor isn't really influencing the policy as strongly as he should be. It's one or the other, and neither is particularly flattering.
I was just going to say neither so good. Charlie, your thoughts?
Well, I'm just shocked that there would be any union strong-arming going on in Boston. But
allegedly,
that's right. But, what I think this comes down to is a couple of things. One is, Boston and Massachusetts are unusual. This is not the way it is in the rest of the country, but the reality is that we live in a place where, 18 out of the 20 political action committees that give the most to candidates are labor organizations. I mean, labor's power is outsized here, and Boston is the epicenter of that power. And anytime you're in a situation like that, there is certainly a greater chance for corruption or for going a little bit too far. Now, That said, I think the question, there is an open question as to whether this is unseemly or if it's criminal.
Right.
And that's a very different thing. And, you know, we're going to have to wait and see if it rises to that level.
Legally, that's the heart of the case,
right.
I mean, isn't it? I mean, Dante, I see you.
Well, I was going to respond. You know, I think there's a couple different strands here. You know, in terms of whether it's illegal, if the administration had a written policy saying that we'll give permits and 50% of the jobs on those things will be union jobs, that is, you know, that would arguably be a policy. Whether that's legal or not could be tested in court. If it happens behind the scenes, I mean, it does. If that did happen, I mean, it is kind of strong-arming in one way or another. So, you know, I don't think it's exactly just a pro-labor mayor or pro-labor administration having a pro-labor policy. The other part I wanted to respond to was the suggestion from the lawyer for Mr. Sullivan that the Supreme Court decision somehow, you know, somehow would make this prosecution irrelevant.
Hold that thought, Dante, because I want to hear what you have to say, but I want to play a little bit more from William Santoliu on exactly this point, because he went into, when he spoke in front of federal court this week, he went into some very specific detail about that case. And so this was the case that the high court decided this week regarding former Virginia Governor Bob McDonald, who had faced a conviction for doing political favors for businessmen who had given the governor money and in gifts and loans in exchange for some kind of access. But his conviction, McDonald's conviction, was overturned by the Supreme Court. Now, Sullivan's lawyer here in Boston, William Santoliu, really went to great pains to reference that case. So here's more tape.
The Supreme Court specifically said setting up meetings of this nature are not only not criminal, but they would chill any politician's effect of doing his job. The day after that decision was rendered by the United States Supreme Court, this office indicted my client. I'm hoping that they read that decision. I'm expecting that this court will give the Supreme Court a little bit more respect than the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Okay, Dante, your thoughts.
I think that's an impressive bit of table pounding by that particular attorney. The defendants in this case are not being accused of setting up meetings. They're being accused of withholding permits for a legal enterprise. And
or as the reporters tried to ask, did they strong arm?
Right.
Santoliu doesn't answer.
So, that's an official act. Withholding permits is an official act. You know, the Virginia case was a little bit curious, where it was clear that the governor took a lot of money that he probably shouldn't have taken. What was less clear was what precisely he did for the other, you know, did for the other parties. It's actually, in this case, it's almost the exact opposite. It's pretty clear what the people are being accused of. It is an official act.
Yeah. So, Charlie, I want to turn back to something that you said a little earlier, and that was you mentioned that the number of
the political action committees.
Committees that are supported by labor in Boston. I mean, are you implying there that just that fact alone should make people look askance? I mean, wouldn't that be true for any political action committee, regardless of who they're supported
by? I think that sometimes there is a number or a little factoid that really tells you a whole lot about the area of politics. And certainly, whether you're whatever you feel about labor, I really am not anti-labor. I just think that I am troubled by any organization that gains the level of power that they have here. And I just think that when you have, 18 out of 20 of the political action committees that give the most money in Massachusetts being labor organizations, then it sort of tells you who wields the power here. And again, I think that this is certainly not the case nationally. I think it's a very different picture. But I think that they wield power here in what is a one-party state that is that reaches a level that is it is not healthy for any organization or any entity or any interest group to have the level of power that they have here.
You know, but on the other hand, when we talked about this on our show earlier this week, we were thinking about how that fact that you mentioned about the number of PACs in Massachusetts was the same when Mayor Menino was mayor of Boston for 20 years, right? And yet there was nothing. I mean, his administration was squeaky clean.
Right. No, absolutely. And I don't think it means that, every that every politician, as a result, you know, is doing bad things. But I think that it does mean that you get a situation where you have sort of the confluence of a guy who has a very strong labor background becoming the mayor, that we have things like, I think what most people around the country would say is sort of a crazy anti-privatization law. You know, there are these sort of ways in which it shows itself in the way that our politics are run here.
Dante?
I just wanted to underscore, Meghna, the point that you just made a minute ago about the contrast between, you know, the Menino administration and the current administration. You know, one of the barriers that Walsh faces here is the realization that most people have that, yeah, there was 20 years where this kind of scandal wasn't, you know, where you didn't hear about this kind of thing. And at the least, you know, Tom Menino was someone who had a very firm hand over his own administration and a lot of other things in the city, for better or for worse. And I think it, you know, it obviously in the minds of the public will raise questions at the least about, you know, the extent to which Mayor Walsh is in control of his own situation.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's turn now to another major story this week, and that's the latest chapter in the serious tumult at Boston Latin School. It's been buffeted by controversy since allegations back in January by two students of multiple racial incidents at the school. Last week, the school's headmaster, Lynn Mooney Tata, and assistant headmaster, Malcolm Flynn, announced their resignations. And this week, Superintendent Tommy Chang named Michael Contempassis to be interim headmaster. Contempassis has actually been in that post before. He was headmaster for 22 years at Boston Latin from 1976 to 1998. So, first of all, Charlie, let me just get your quick thoughts on this naming of Michael Contempassis as interim headmaster at Latin.
Well, I have to say that it's making me feel kind of old, because back in the dark ages when I worked in college admissions here at BU, we went over to in the 80s to Boston Latin and met with Michael Contempassis, and now he's back there. But I have to say that I'm biased. I know Michael Contempassis a little bit, and I really think very highly of him. And I think that clearly these sort of racial incidents are not, you know, there has to be, you know, zero tolerance for that kind of thing. And I think he is the kind of guy who will take charge and won't let that happen. And I, you know, to be honest with you, in what is a highly political world, I also like the idea that he's interim. He's not looking for his next job, and he just has going to have the freedom to do whatever he thinks is right during his tenure there. So I think he is a good selection.
You know, and one thing that Boston Latin parents have been telling me is that the school right now, more than anything, needs some stability, which, you know, hopefully he can bring. But Dante, your thoughts?
I would agree. I think Contempassis is a, you know, he's an old pro. He's been in the school system for a long time and, you know, provides a certain level of stability. I will say that the current tension at Boston Latin is the latest outgrowth of a dynamic that has existed for many years at that school, and frankly is present in a lot of urban school districts around the country where there is a majority-minority population among the school children, and yet there's a magnet school where that attracts people from across the city, typically at the high school level. You see it in a lot of other cities that attracts a disproportionately white population. And I don't know that – I think there's a lot of school districts that struggle with how to approach this in an equitable manner, because you have the most visible public school in the city being seen in some quarters as a symbol of inequality by, you know, certain members of certain minority communities. And it's been something that's very destructive to harmony in a lot of school districts.
Right.
And there's a lot of difference from city to city in terms of how that's dealt with. You know, some cities just have a straight, you know, sort of test-based who gets in that's entirely blind. Other states or other cities don't and, you know, have more of a sliding scale. So there are a whole lot of issues involved with that.
Well, even at Boston Latin back in the day, decades ago, they didn't even have the exam, right?
But, right.
And then they introduced an exam, and then there were two court cases. And then at one point in time, they had what they were calling set-asides for students of color in terms of admissions, and those were knocked down by two federal court cases. And so the school itself has tried, you know, multiple ways of dealing with, as Dante, as you said, this long running question of who makes up the student body there. I mean, to me, it's like sometimes it's hard to really sort of tease out all the different parts of this story, because there's the immediate yes. need of addressing what the culture is at Boston Latin. Because I think when so many people, so many young people come forward and say, we've been made to feel uncomfortable, there's an issue there that needs to be looked at. Yep. Then there's also that broader issue of, okay, well, you know, if Boston is going to do a better job, if the district is going to do a better job of preparing young students of color in the district as a whole who want to take the exam and go to Boston Latin, how should it do that? Is it doing it in the right way? Are they doing enough outreach, enough prep? I mean, sometimes I think these two things are getting sort of smashed together in the public conversation about what's happening.
Yeah, you know, it's the sometimes conflicting, certainly not always, but sometimes conflicting sort of values of excellence and equity. And, you know, sort of sorting that out and threading the needle is an awfully hard thing to do.
I would just add on, I think there are a couple of other dynamics that are making this situation particularly delicate. First of all, you have a new superintendent who's from Los Angeles and so, you know, is kind of gradually getting the feel of how of the dynamics in the Boston school system, but doesn't at this point necessarily have a firm command of who all the groups are. I think there's also, it's kind of a delicate political moment for the Walsh administration. You know, I think the previous segment illustrated that. But, you know, I think conventional wisdom in political circles is that Walsh, who enjoyed significant support from Black and Latino voters in his last election, you know, is looking over his shoulder for, you know, in case there are challengers within the Black or Latino communities, and that this is something that is a test of his ability to handle a potentially very divisive issue. And so I think the stakes are actually quite high.
Yeah, especially given that Tito Jackson, who could be that challenger, is also, I think he's the chair of the Council's Education Committee, has been very involved in this issue, and you know, a year from now we'll be in the midst of a mayoral campaign.
Well, and obviously the question of what to do regarding Boston schools and specifically Latin is going to go on, and we'll keep covering that. But let's plow ahead here to another story from this week. And that has to do with the Senate's bill on ride-hailing companies. Because on Wednesday, the state Senate passed a bill, 34-2, that would require ride-hailing companies like Uber or Lyft to provide driver information to the state for a background check. That bill, however, has to be reconciled with the House version, which was passed back in March. And just a little bit more background here. Both versions would regulate ride-hailing companies under the Department of Public Utilities. The House, though, requires an additional state-conducted background check for drivers. So your thoughts, Dante. Let's start with you.
There's a big difference between the House bill and the Senate bill on this. The House bill made an honest effort, and we can talk about whether it's, you know, it'll be an effective effort or not, but made an honest effort to split the difference between the interests of the ride-hailing companies and the incumbent taxi industry. And so there were some provisions in the House bill that would, you know, protect taxi companies in various ways. The Senate bill basically said, look, you know, that's kind of a lost battle, and we'll, you know, we'll try to regulate the ride-hailing companies in a more kind of modern, more efficient manner, and didn't really leave a whole lot of the measures that the ride-hailing taxi industry had wanted. You know, the taxi industry basically wants to make things maximally difficult for Uber and Lyft, and that's why they, along with the police chiefs, have been pushing this fingerprinting issue. I mean, my own opinion is that the fingerprinting doesn't really contribute a ton to public safety, and Boston didn't start, you know, after 100 years of having cabs, didn't start fingerprinting drivers literally until a few months ago. So that issue is a little bit of a red herring from my point of view, but it does speak to, you know, how much the bill is tilted towards the taxi industry or the ride-hailing companies.
I mean, I take your point about why you would see it as a red herring, but I think there are people, maybe even beyond the taxi industry itself, who do say that, you know, yes, the technology is changing how we live, but that doesn't mean that we should get relaxed about things like public safety. Charlie?
Well, I tell you, I really prefer the Senate bill. I think that the House bill comes out as sort of government putting their thumb on the scales in a way that I just don't think it is helpful. I mean, you know, for example, the House saying, well, these ride-hailing vehicles can't go to the convention center or can't go to Logan or pulling this money out of this, some economic development fund and sort of giving it to these wealthy cab medallion owners to try to prop them up because the reality is that they're having trouble competing. I just think that this is a classic kind of economic disruptor, and either the taxi industry is going to learn how to improve and be able to compete with it, or they're going to kind of go the way of the typewriter. And I think that on balance, that's never smooth, but I think on balance, that's a good thing for consumers.
Mm. Well, let's play a couple pieces of tape here from some folks we talked to this week about it. Chris Taylor, we spoke to him. He's the Boston General Manager for Uber. And he spoke to us earlier this week about how he says that he favors that companies themselves do the background checks rather than drivers having to report to a State Department for a state-conducted check. And in the clip you're about to hear, he talks about folks and their CORI records. That's the criminal offender record information. So here's Chris Taylor.
The safety outcome is going to be the same. We want that CORI check done. We're supportive of that. But we'd love to have it be more convenient for drivers so that they don't have to jump through hoops unnecessarily.
Mm. And State Senator Linda Dorsino-Fori advocated for fingerprinting, Dante, that red herring of yours, in addition to background checks on the Senate floor. Here she is.
Well, we know TNCs are part of the infrastructure here in the Commonwealth, part of the transportation economy and the mode for people to get around. We are not trying to kill TNCs. We are trying to be fair.
She talks about TNCs, which are transportation network companies. So, Dante, let me just quickly ask you about something that that Charlie said and was sort of echoed in that piece of tape from Senator Dorsino-Fori about, how much should government be involved when it comes to the emergence of these new really sort of life-changing technologies or ways of living or parts of our economy. I mean, she says it right there. We're not trying to kill them. We're trying to be fair. Does the government have any role in this at all?
This does. One of the reasons it's such an interesting debate to watch is it's a much more libertarian type of discussion than we're used to watching here in Massachusetts. I think there is a kind of there's a certain level of uncertainty about what role the government should play. The prevailing view 100 years ago about taxis was that, yeah, you needed a lot of government oversight to provide a safe ride to people. Now the theory that's being put out by the ride-hailing companies, and I have to say I tend to agree with it, is that there are other means of achieving that other than having you go down to the precinct and get fingerprinted.
Hmm. Well, Charlie, last thought?
Yeah, no, I agree, that whole argument's going to change when President Johnson and Vice President Weld take over.
Oh, well, on that note, let's save a little bit of time for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that maybe weren't top of mind this week, but deserve a fair shake anyway. So, Dante, what's your hubbub?
Well, my hubbub is about the zillions of germs in the MBTA. If you're riding the MBTA home this afternoon, despite what I just said, relax. According to a study released this week by Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, the microbes lurking in Boston's public transportation system are no more harmful than anything that you would encounter from a handshake. For 3 days, researchers from Harvard traveled through the T network, swabbing basically every surface they could find. And okay, the straps on the subway cars were a little bit dodgy, as were the fabric seats. But the metal poles, as it turns out, were relatively clean because germs can't stick to them. Last year, another group of researchers had claimed that New York subway had traces of bubonic plague and anthrax, but not the tea. Not infected with anthrax may be a low standard, but in these uncertain times, you take what you can get.
So I have two responses to that. One is, just as safe as a handshake, a lot of people out there are going, ew, handshakes, right? And second, when my second kid was born and was very tiny, I actually took him on the tea one day, and this woman came up to me and first of all looked at me like I was committing an act of child abuse. She said, you're a very brave mother. So to that lady, yes, Dante's story does affirm that I was being brave,
right.
Maybe not so brave.
Well, I would also add that, all those people who are waiting to get over the Sagamore Bridge right now, it could be worse. At least they're not on the tea with the bubonic plague.
No bubonic plague on the tea.
No, I'm sorry. New York. Yes, you're right.
Charlie, your hubbub.
Well, my hubbub this week is about the need to save the Citgo sign.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there was great news this week. As you may know, BU is going to sell the building, apparently, that the Citgo sign sells, sits atop. And there is an effort afoot for the Boston Landmarks Commission to take up a measure to actually recall the Citgo sign a landmark, so that if that happens, they would have to go through this commission if they were to make any change to the sign, as one of millions of generations of drunken BU students who found their way back over the years, thanks to being able to look up and see the Citgo sign, even though if you're on Storrow Drive and it twists and turns, after a while you're starting to think that maybe you're hallucinating because it's there and it's there. But nonetheless, the Citgo sign, I think, needs to be a permanent landmark here in Boston, and I applaud the efforts to save it.
I agree. It's one of those things that I could always look for on the horizon, and I feel like I know exactly where I am, depending on where the Citgo sign
is. It's also a beacon to Boston Marathon runners.
Yes.
One more
you're
mile.
You're almost there, exactly.
That's right.
Well, so my hubbub falls under the category of a good business person knows how to make lemonade out of lemons, or in this case, some money off of, I don't know if I can call it rotten apples, because the Boston Beer Company is seeking to put a trademark on the word Brexit for a new hard cider that the makers of Sam Adams are trying to create. So great little opportunity there. However, I would note that I'm very close to someone who's from the southwestern part of England that makes a lot of cider. And he points out that not every county in southwestern England did vote to leave the EU. So he wanted me to tell the folks at Sam Adams, you cannot use a cider recipe that comes from Exeter because they voted to stay. All right. Brexit trademarking attempts by
Boston
Beer
Company.
That's
why Coke is a billionaire and we're not. He thinks of those kind of things.
Jim Cook. Right.
That's right.
The Cokes are billionaires too.
Yeah, they're billionaires too. That's true.
And the three of us are still not. So.
Yes.
Charlie Gippio, research fellow at the Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation at the Harvard Kennedy School and head of Gippio Strategies. Always great to have you. Thank you so much. And Dante Ramos, columnist for the op-ed page of the Boston Globe. Great to have you, and happy 4th of July weekend to
you
both
too.
Of you.
Happy 4th to you and everyone.
Yes.
We'll be back. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The city of Worcester has agreed to pay a settlement of more than $2 million to a young woman who says she was coerced into confessing that she suffocated her one-month-old son. Na Trong was just 16 years old when, in 2008, Worcester police detectives questioned her for hours, leading to her confession. She spent nearly 3 years in jail before a judge tossed out the confession, saying it was the product of deception by the detectives. As part of the settlement, the city of Worcester says all parties in the suit are prohibited from discussing the case. WBUR's David Boeri, though, first reported on Na Trong's interrogation, and he explains what led to yesterday's settlement.
Now, you said earlier, you're going to tell me the truth. I'm waiting. No, you didn't.
It was December 2008, and two Worcester police detectives had a young Vietnamese-American girl named Na Trong in the box, a small, cramped room used for interrogations. The day before, Na Trong's 13-month-old baby had stopped breathing. Worcester 911 responded to a pleading, hysterical phone call. A doctor at a nearby hospital declared him dead. In the box, a video player records the interrogation.
Because that medical examiner told me that baby was smothered. Does that change your story? We have scientific evidence that boy was smothered to death.
In fact, what the police detective was telling Trong was not true. Doctors and the medical examiner had said no such thing. The detective was lying to her. Part of the playbook. The autopsy actually states the cause of death was undetermined, and the death certificate said strep throat was a contributing factor.
Please believe
it. I don't believe you because I believe the scientists. I believe the doctors.
Trong was alone. She had no lawyer. And as Judge Janet Kenton Walker later ruled, the cops had not given her proper Miranda warnings. Back in 2011, Ed Ryan, who was appointed Trong's attorney after she was arrested, told me that Trong's first words to him were, she didn't do it.
Psychological torture is the best way to describe what they did to this young woman. And quite frankly, their interrogation was designed not to determine the truth, not to get at the facts. Their interrogation was designed to force her to confess to doing it in the way they figured she did it.
The judge described Truong as frightened, meek, emotionally compromised. Truong continued to insist she was innocent, just as the detectives continued to insist she was guilty.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, we're going to go now. Cut
the I'm not lying.
The turning point in the 2 hours of taped interrogation comes after the detectives promise Truong that if she admits to what she did, they will take her to juvenile court, where there's minimal punishment. But if she doesn't cooperate, they threaten, they'll push to try her as an adult. In 2011, I asked Truong,
so why would you confess to committing something that you didn't do?
It was a pretty long 2 hours, and all I heard throughout those 2 hours is that they're going to give me help if I confessed. And so that, I'm sorry.
In the videotape just before she confesses, the detectives promise a reward. They will get her younger brothers, whom Na was raising herself, into a good family and away from their mother, who was judged to be unfit. After watching the interrogation, Judge Kenton Walker wrote this. With notable naivete, Na believed what the officers told her. All she wanted to know was whether she and her brothers would now be able to go to a foster home. Back in 2011, when asked to analyze that interrogation, retired State Superior Court Judge Robert Barton, with a reputation as a tough, no-nonsense judge, had no doubts.
One thing I did tell my wife while the child was being interrogated, thank God we have courts and judges.
The Worcester Police Department, like the city of Worcester, never apologized for its actions against Na Truong. Former police chief Gary Jem opened a Twitter account that he used to criticize the judge who threw out Truong's so-called confession. Her lawyers did not make her available for comment.
That's WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. David's reporting on this case is deep and extensive. Go to WBUR.org for more. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So, if this version of the Star Spangled Banner sounds, I don't know, a little off, it's not just you. It's an arrangement by composer Igor Stravinsky, written in 1941. And when he performed the arrangement in Boston during the middle of the Second World War, he landed himself in some hot water with local authorities. We're going to hear that story in just a moment, but first, let's listen to a little bit more of Stravinsky's Star Spangled Banner. So again, nice, but maybe a little bit different. So joining us now with more is Carly Carioli. He's contributing editor for Politico, and he wrote about Stravinsky's unorthodox rendition for the Boston Globe. Carly, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So I love this version. I mean, it's very beautiful, but there is something a little not quite right about it.
It's a little off.
Yeah.
But it certainly doesn't sound radical to our ears, maybe perhaps the way it did to the listeners in 1944.
In 1944. Okay, so in your story in the Globe, you say that this story begins and ends with a photo. And what photo specifically are you talking about?
Sure. So I first came across this photo sort of the way that you do on the internet. it's a black and white photo. Looks like a mugshot. It's Igor Stravinsky, at that time maybe the world's greatest living composer.
And it looks like a mugshot because he's got a little Boston Police placard.
Yeah, he's got a placard around his neck. It's got a date on it, 1940, Boston Police. And I came across it on a blog called Boing Boing, which, despite the name, is a pretty authoritative blog. And they said they had gotten it from Neil Gaiman, who's a novelist and has lived in Cambridge. And Neil had sent it to them with the story that this was a mugshot of Igor Stravinsky from when he was arrested in Boston for the crime of performing an illicit version of the Star Spangled Banner with the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. So first of all, let me just ask you, the crime of performing an illicit version of the Star Spangled Banner? It's a crime in Massachusetts?
That was my thought. So I immediately sort of had lived in Boston for 25 years, had not heard that story, and immediately tried to figure out how that came to be. Quickly found out, as you can, that it's an apocryphal story. It is not a mugshot, and he was not arrested. But he did have a run-in with the Boston police. There was a crime committed, according to them, and it did have some consequences.
Yeah. So let's just say, I mean, in your reporting, you did find that there is a law that's on the books to this day that says in Massachusetts you cannot perform unorthodox versions of the Star Spangled Banner.
Sure, that's correct. He didn't know that, and certainly nobody at the time really knew that. The law dates from 1917, when the Star Spangled Banner did not officially become the national anthem of the United States until 1931. But in 1917, President Woodrow Wilson makes it the official anthem of the Army, Navy, and the Marines. And at that point, he issues a command to all of the armed forces bands that they are no longer able to perform that song as part of a medley, or with embellishment, or as dance music. And those are the three things that they are very afraid of for some reason. And that gets carried through into a Massachusetts law that's passed in 1917, just barely. There was some argument about the passing of it. Yeah. Not everybody agreed with it.
Well, but as you reported it in your story for the Globe, Igor Stravinsky in 1941, I believe, July 4th, 1941,
yes,
wrote this version.
Version. The law dates to 1917, yeah, and everybody, I think, forgets about it. So you fast forward to 1941. He writes this version of the anthem. He debuts it a couple of places. It doesn't get much response. And he comes to Boston in January of 1944. He's quite popular in Boston, probably more popular in Boston than he was anywhere else in the country. Serge Koussevitzky, the legendary conductor of the Boston Symphony, has played his music before, but Stravinsky's now coming to conduct the orchestra in a program of his own works. He plays it, as they do, at Sanders Theater on a Thursday night. Then he comes to Boston on Friday afternoon.
And no one really notices. No one makes a big deal out of
it. No one makes a big deal. But they do say, the next day, there is no mention of it in the Boston Globe. There's no mention of it in the Herald. But there is an AP reporter who reports that the audience, as tradition, the conductor faces the audience, which means he wants you to sing. And they all stand up, as you do for the national anthem, and they attempt to sing along, but they can't follow. And this has actually happened a couple of times before he's performed it in Boston. And the audience, as the AP later reports, greets this in stunned silence. Mm. The next day, it's all across the country.
You thought social media was bad. This thing, there was no social media at all, and it only took a day.
and not only that. I mean, by Saturday morning, there has already been not only the outcry nationally of Russian composer messes with national anthem, performs it, and everybody greets it weirdly, and there was also some backlash to that, and he had sort of some early editions of Saturday papers indicated that he was set to perform it again Saturday night for a national radio audience on NBC, and that he was, despite that, sticking with the anthem.
Mm. I mean, and he could have been arrested. I mean, authorities were there ready to arrest him?
So what happens on Saturday is kind of interesting. I mean, even though there's been this outcry, nobody knows that it's against the law. And he claims that, Stravinsky claims, that a half hour before curtain time, several police officers show up in the dressing room, including one police officer is the head of the Radical Squad. Apparently there was a Radical Squad in 1944 for the Boston Police. And they inform him, they show him the regulation, and say that they threaten they will take the music off the stands if he attempts to perform it again. And quickly, he has a quick decision to make. And he stands down. But as people are listening in on the radio and people have flocked to their radios because this is all over the news, everybody's waiting to hear what this crazy arrangement of the Star-Spangled Banner is. And then he gets on and does the regular one.
Right.
And then it's an even bigger story because now you have this idea that there must have been something very illicit about this this version, something dangerous and scary and foreign.
So, you know, so obviously he didn't get arrested. So that original photograph that we talked about was not a mugshot. It was even taken years before.
Correct. So this happens in 1944, and the photo is from 1940.
Yeah. So, Carly, my last question to you is, to me, this is such an American story. I mean, what's more American than taking some sort of, you know, piece of music or tradition that we have and having an immigrant make it his or her own, sometimes to awkward reception, but other times to great reception. I mean, to me, that was one of the takeaways from the story.
Yeah, and he had written it in 1941 as the intention of having it be a gift to the American people. One of the big complaints about the national anthem is always that it's very hard to sing. In fact, that's one of the arguments against making it the actual national anthem. And he wanted to write a version that was easier to sing and also that kind of brought out a little more of a hymnal quality to it. And then I think that is part of the irony of it is that despite that, it was sort of branded, this innovation to make it more democratic, more singable for everyone, was branded foreign and frightening.
Well, Carly Carioli is a contributing editor for Politico. His story about Igor Stravinsky's unorthodox version of the Star-Spangled Banner and its reaction from Boston audiences appeared in the Boston Globe, and we've got a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Carly, thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
Thank you.
Well, the 4th of July weekend is almost here, and over at the Hatch Shell on the Esplanade today, workers are putting finishing touches on the stage, hoisting those huge speakers onto towers, running thousands of feet of cable, all in preparation for Monday's 4th of July spectacular. This year marks a turning point for the Boston tradition. It's the final celebration for two of the event's central figures. Businessman and philanthropist David Mugar is retiring. He's been executive producer of the event for 43 years. Also retiring, Angelo Tillis. He's manager of the Hatch Shell and district supervisor for the Department of Conservation and Recreation, a post he's held for more than 30 years. Now, you may not have heard of Angelo Tillis, but every year when Maestro Keith Lockhart and the Boston Pops take to the stage and everything goes off without a hitch, Angelo Tillis is the man to thank. We met Mr. Tillis at the Hatch Shell this morning, and the first thing he did asked us if we wanted to stand on stage. Answer, yes.
Can I stand on this?
1,000%, Angelo. Anything for you, buddy.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, now you're on the stage.
Now we're on the stage. This is absolutely a first for me. Well, thank you so much for talking to us. I mean, there's so much activity and setup going on for Monday. But we're talking to you because you're retiring this year.
Yes,
why?
I am. I'm in my 34th year with first the MDC and now with the DCR. And I'm 64 years old, and it's time.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you first got into this job,
Absolutely.
Managing this?
My boss, Bill Gary, who was a commissioner at the time, said, you know, we want to have you work at the Hatch Shell. And I said, I don't think so. Nights, weekends, holidays, all summer? Nah, I don't think so. He said, well, I'll give it a shot. And that was in 1984.
And worked out?
I had worked the 4th of July in 83. Obviously, an event like this where you get anywhere from 2 to 500,000 people, it's like, it's a thrill.
So in 84, that first year that you were in charge of managing it, how did that first 4th of July go?
Went great. I really didn't have much clue as to what was going on. I don't know that I still do, but it was a little difficult. But the people, David Mugar, who's like family, this whole B4 crew was his family know.
Well, and there's a lot of changes happening for Boston's fourth celebration. I mean, you mentioned David Mugar. Now you're retiring as well. But so let me ask you, I mean, standing here on the stage of the Hat Shell, it's, I mean, obviously as beautiful as everyone could imagine it being. But it didn't look like this when you first got started.
No, actually, it was in disrepair. And the roof was leaking. We had barrels in the hallway downstairs catching rainwater, and it rained 2 days. After it stopped raining outside, it was still raining 2 days later inside. So, yeah, it was pretty bad.
And I read that you had to have your crew, like, hold together the bandstand with nails and screws.
Duct tape and everything else. I was in a sad state of affairs, but thanks to my old friend, God rest his soul, Harry Ellis Dixon, who kind of hounded his father-in-law, Michael Dukakis, we got it done. In 1990-91, we did a $5.5 million renovation. This is what we got.
And it's worth every penny.
Yep, so, absolutely.
So let me ask you, what was some of the toughest things about doing this job? Because the Boston's fourth celebration is, you know, one of the most popular ones in the country. But I can't even imagine the amount of work that you guys have to do running up to the fourth every year.
The DCR is we're more, you know, we're the property owners, we're the facilitators. As you can see, these guys are doing a lot of the heavy lifting, the scenic people, the capron lighting and sound. We're charged with making sure the place looks nice every day, even during this. So that's a challenge.
Well, I was just going to say, because, I mean, so many people. So talk to me about when you encourage people to take home some souvenirs at the end of every fourth celebration.
Yep, I go out with a megaphone, and I kind of tell everybody, hey, we have free souvenirs available. Just reach down and grab a handful of confetti, and there's your souvenir. And whoever's listening now, please, if you come, help me out. Grab a handful. It's a good souvenir. I mean, you can say, I got this at the Hat Show.
Can you tell me about one of your favorite moments here? I read that 1/4 of July, you got to actually watch the fireworks with Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash, yes. He was awesome. He had a motorhome parked right behind the Hat Show, and right after he finished his last song, he had come downstairs, and he was headed up towards his motorhome, and he said, I want you and another guy that was here, Rich Savickas, my assistant at the time. He said, I want you guys to come up and sit on the thing and sit on the trailer and watch the fireworks. And I was like, geez, I can't. I'm too busy. I'm like, I have a lot to do. He said, I don't care. For 15 minutes, you can come up and sit with me. And we did. And he was great. I mean, you know, I've met a lot of people over the years, a lot of celebrities, a lot of stars, singers, and whatever. But he was probably one of the best.
Everyone from Johnny Cash to Nelson Mandela, right?
Nelson Mandela was one of my best days here.
Tell me about it.
Well, obviously, he had just gotten out of prison.
This is 1990, right?
Yep. He'd just gotten out of prison, and he was quite the guy. He came in, introduced himself, like we didn't know who he was, introduced himself. We chatted for a little bit. I got an awesome picture with him, and I remember that forever. I mean, a guy like him, and, you know, to sit down and chat with us was wonderful.
I'm dying to ask you, on the night of the 4th, when the Pops are up here and Keith Lockhart picks up his baton and is ready to go, where are you usually?
I'm right in the stairwell leading up to the stage holding my baton in case Keith gets sick. If anything happens to him, I told him I'm ready to go. So he's a great guy. Everybody that's involved with this 4th of July, it's a family. It's just an awesome, awesome event.
What have been some of your favorite
moments?
I am
going to miss it. Excuse me.
Oh, yeah. Been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, I have. It's been fun. It's been a blast. And I'm going to have my family here this year. They usually don't come because it's, you know, Dad and Grandpa is busy doing stuff, so he doesn't have time to sit down with them. And unfortunately, it's going to be the same. But for my last 4th of July, I'm my wife and kids and grandchildren. My mother hasn't been here in 24 years. She's coming, so it's going to be a blast.
Now I'm feeling all teary. Well, we're going to air this today, and if Maestro Lockhart is hearing this, I'm hoping that maybe he will hand you the baton.
Yeah, well, you know what? I don't know what I'll do.
Well, Angelo, just thank you so much for your many, many years of service and work here. The 4th of July celebration is an incredibly important part of what makes Boston, Boston. And year-round, looking after the Esplanade, thank you so very much.
And I want to thank you. And I want to thank the people of the Commonwealth who obviously pay me to be here for the opportunity to do what I've done over the last, some, let me see, I lost count, but whatever how many years I've been here. It's just been a great opportunity, and I've been happy to do what I've been doing, and if I had to do it over again, I'd do it all over again exactly the same way.
Well, thank you. We'll get out of your way because there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Okay.
That's Angelo Tillis, Hatch Shell Manager for more than 30 years. He's retiring later this year. If you see him on Monday, hats off to him. Now, just a quick note before we wrap up. We've got a great 4th of July show lined up for you on Monday. And after that, I'm taking a couple of weeks off. And then I'm helping out the hardworking folks at Here and Now with their political convention coverage. So I'll be away from Radio Boston for a bit more than a month. And I will miss you. But you will be in excellent hands, as always. And I will be back with you at this time again in August. So have a fantastic and safe holiday weekend. For now, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.